Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Lynn Olson's latest book, Citizens of London, it's about the alliance between the U.S. and England during World War II and the men who forged that alliance through the power of personal diplomacy. It's also about America and England at the time and the impact of Americans on the English during the war. Lynn Olson, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You're a former White House correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, and you've written other books along this line, Troublesome Young Men, The Rebels Who Brought Churchill to Power and Helped Save England, and also The Murrow Boys, Pioneers on the Front Line of Broadcast Journalism. But why these three folks, John Gilbert Wynant, Averill Harriman, and Edward R. Murrow?
Well, they were the three most important Americans in London, in Britain, before the U.S. got into the war, and to some extent after America got in. They played very large roles, all three of them, in helping to create the Anglo-American alliance, and then once it was formed, helping keep it alive, because it was not an easy thing to do.
I guess I was surprised by the notion of how little Americans and Britons knew about each other.
Well, you know, I really was too, and I grew up pretty much an Anglophile, and so I knew a fair amount about England. Mm-hmm. I thought, and I thought everybody else did too. But certainly back then, you know, there wasn't the ease of transportation and communication that we have now. So most Americans, you know, a huge majority had never been in England, much less knew very much about it. And certainly that was true of the British as well. And so there was, despite our common, you know, language and history and heritage, there was an extraordinary amount of ignorance and lack of understanding about the other countries.
The British looked down on Americans in general before the war.
A large number of them did. Yeah, there was a kind of a condescension,
mm-hmm, that, right.
Certainly among, you know, in the higher levels of the British government,
military,
and British society,
mm-hmm,
you know, patronizing, looking at Americans as kind of misbehaving colonists, you know, rather than you know, independent, equal,
and sort of that feeling that we were kind of climbers.
Right, exactly, social climbers. And, you know, and on, by the same token, a lot of Americans felt, kind of not inferior, but they certainly resented that kind of attitude. And it was interesting, you know, when I was doing my research, I found that people that you wouldn't think would have that sense of inferiority, like Dwight Eisenhower and Eleanor Roosevelt, mm-hmm, but they did, you know, when they went over to England and were exposed to especially the upper class of British society.
Winston Churchill figured out very quickly to befriend this trio.
Yes, he did.
But he's a very, you know, he's a very smart guy and very tactical, but he also seemed to genuinely like them.
Yeah, I think he did, but I think his reaching out to them was first and foremost,
yes,
a question of strategy. I mean, he knew how important these three men were to British survival at that time. I mean, we have to remember that I begin the book really in early 1941, when it wasn't clear that Britain was going to, in fact, hold out against England, I mean, against Hitler,
mm-hmm,
and Germany. England was standing all by itself at that point. Everybody else, every other country in Western Europe had been defeated by Germany, and it wasn't, it looked actually that they were going to go down the tubes. And so Churchill knew that the only way Britain could survive was through American help. And he knew that these three Americans were incredibly important to get that aid. And so he reached out to them. He really brought them into his official family. But even more, he made them part of his personal family, particularly Wynant, mm-hmm, Gil Wynant, who was the ambassador, and Averill Harriman, who was in charge of Lend-Lease.
You know, before we go on, I want to remind everybody, my guest right now is Lynn Olson. She's the author of Citizens of London. It's about the folks who forged the alliance between the United States and England during World War II. You know, really, by the end of the book, Lynn, in my heart, the main character of it, of the story, was London.
Absolutely. Actually, I that was my purpose, one of my purposes in writing the book. As you mentioned, have written a number of books previously that have to deal with Britain during World War II. And in doing research for those books, I was just captivated by London and the role of London in the war. It was an amazingly exciting, exhilarating city to be in. In fact, probably the most exciting city in the world at that time. And I wanted to do a book about London. And so I combined that idea with the idea of the British-American Alliance and these three men who played such a major role.
There was a moment in the book where I can't remember the characters now, but somebody was walking with a Polish freedom fighter or somebody from Poland, and they were kind of walking down the streets of London just looking around them in sort of awe and wonder. It was the what you call the preciousness of freedom.
That's right. You know, London for occupied Europe was kind of a beacon of freedom. It was, as I said, it was the capital of the last country in Europe standing independently against Hitler, who was still fighting against Hitler. And to the millions of people in Norway and Poland and Czechoslovakia and all those other countries that had been defeated by Hitler, it was the place that everybody wanted to go to, and many thousands escaped from those countries and came to London, including the governments of most of those countries, and they formed governments in exile in London. So London was really the capital, the ex officio capital of Europe at that point, which was one of the reasons why it was so exciting to be there.
It's hard to think, you know, for all the movies I've seen and the books I've read, but mostly about England from, you know, a long, long time before this. But what happened during the Blitz has never sunk in like it did in your descriptions. And a lot of it through the experience of Gil Winant.
Right. Gil Winant, as I mentioned, was the American ambassador to Britain during this time. And he was beloved by the British people. And one reason why he was is that during the worst raids of the Blitz, he would go out on the streets of London and just walk the streets. And every person that he met, every Brit that he met, he would ask what he could do to help. And at that point, the British had no love for the Americans because they hadn't gotten into the war yet. And for many of them, Gil Winant's caring was the first sign, tangible sign, that they had that America did, in fact, care what happened to them. But it was an extraordinary time, an awful time. I mean, every night for over 2 months, almost 3 months, German bombers came and bombed the heck out of London. And, you know, thousands of people were killed. Hundreds of thousands of people lost their homes. It was a horrible time, and yet at the same time, it was an incredibly, I mean, exciting is not the right word, but it was exhilarating in the sense, you know, that these people stood up to the German bombers, and they stood up to Germany, and they went on with their lives through it all. I mean, they stood up against Hitler, and it was really the first sign that Britain was going to make it, I think, in the war.
When Gil Winant arrived in London after his appointment as ambassador, he was met by the King of England. Was it the King? No, the Prince.
No, he was met by the King of England. Yes.
It was the King of England.
Right.
I mean, that, right there, right at the train station.
Absolutely. And that, I mean, the King had, a British monarch had never, ever done that to a foreign ambassador. Usually an ambassador, you know, would go to Buckingham Palace and after several weeks of being in the country. But it was a sign. It was a sign that how much Britain needed America, that the King George VI, met Winant on the day he arrived in England at the train station and took him off for talks. I mean, it just showed how in what a desperate situation Britain was at that point.
Why was Gil Winant so suited for this role at that time?
He was suited for a number of ways. He was a former governor of New Hampshire and was a liberal Republican, very much interested in the common man, very compassionate, very warm, probably the best governor that New Hampshire has ever had to this day. He was always interested in doing what he could to help people. And so that was very important, and that's one reason Franklin Roosevelt chose him. But another reason was he had very, very close ties to the labor movement and to the Labor Party in Britain. And Roosevelt was pretty sure that the Labor Party was going to come to power either during the war or right after the war. I mean, the Tory Party with Winston Churchill as Prime Minister was then in power, basically. But the Labor Party was coming up, and that's another key reason why he was picked. He was also, the British really liked him. They knew him. They had known him. Roosevelt knew that they would, they would welcome him with open arms, especially after his, you know, he replaced Joseph Kennedy, who was not very popular, to put it mildly, in Britain. So anybody who replaced Joseph Kennedy was going to be popular, but Gil Winant was extremely popular.
Was Winant immediately for the United States getting involved in the war?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
He had been for the U.S. getting involved even before he went over there. Oh, yeah. He was very much of an interventionist.
When he arrived, he said something to them that was very moving. I mean, I read part of the speech that you had in the book about, you know, that he made, a very quiet speech, but he wasn't a great public speaker, but he was always very well understood by the British. And he said that there's no place I'd rather be.
He said, that's right, when he first arrived, he said, there's no place I'd rather be than in England. And for a country that, you know, was really on its knees, and saw all these Americans, prominently including Joseph Kennedy, leaving by the thousands to get out of there, to have someone arrived, a prominent American arrive and say, there's no place I'd rather be than here, was a tremendous boost to them. And you're right, he was a terrible, terrible speaker, actually. He was very shy and very awkward, but he had an extraordinary presence. And the New York Times once wrote about him that people in his audiences used to listen to him in the beginning of his speeches and felt sorry for him, but by the end of his speeches, they were on their feet cheering him. And that's what happened to him in London, too.
We're going to have to take a short break. My guest is Lynn Olson, author of Citizens of London. Questions or comments for Lynn or about the topic, World War II and the relationship between the United States and England, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Greece goes broke and fear rises that the contagion could spread. On Point looks at the Greek debt crisis and the global response. That discussion at 1 o'clock this afternoon on On Point, right here on WOSU 820. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine this afternoon, a high of 72. A few clouds tonight and a low of 52 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 82. And then clouds move in for Saturday, bringing rain and a chance of thunderstorms for Saturday, a high of 75. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the book Citizens of London with the author, Lynn Olson. Lynn, Averell Harriman felt like an unlikely, I guess, for lack of a hero in this story. He did a lot of good things in the end, but he didn't seem like the likely person to be doing them. And it really was a lot about self-interest and narcissism, it felt like.
You're right. Yeah, he was sent over by Roosevelt to head up the Lend-Lease program for Britain, the aid that eventually was sent to Britain from the U.S. And unlike the other two men that I write about, Winant and Ed Morrow, he was not an idealist. He was basically out for himself and for his country. I mean, he wanted to extend his own power and authority and that of his country. He was a businessman, unlike the other two. He was the head of Union Pacific Railroad, which he inherited really from his father, E.H. Harriman. So he was a multimillionaire businessman. And he was not as interested in, you know, in the public good, let's say, as either Wynant or Murrow. But as you say, he did good things. I mean, he was also, like those other two men, absolutely dedicated to the idea that the U.S. must come to the aid of Britain and must get into the war. And he did everything he could to bring that about.
He, Ed Murrow, an important, well-known character to a lot of people because of his radio broadcasts.
Right.
Very famous. It was interesting that Gil Wynant seemed to embrace the role of educating the English about Americans. Ed Murrow went the other way, on the other side of the coin, to educate Americans about England and the British.
That's right. Murrow saw himself to a large degree as an educator. He always had, you know, from the time he started broadcasting for CBS. And he really saw that as a very key role of his in the war, of telling Americans what the British were like, to, again, because of this lack of knowledge between the two countries, educating them about, you know, about their backgrounds, about history, about, you know, what they were like personally, et cetera. And he had been doing that, actually, even before we got into the war, you know, from the beginning of his broadcast from London. But he also did do some educating of the British. He had a show on the BBC, which was called, I believe, Meet Uncle Sam. Mm-hmm. And so he would describe to the British what Americans were like. And some of the broadcasts, I've heard some of them. They're delightful. I mean, his description of us, you know, for the British.
He was a great great journalist, and because he was so great at telling people what it's like to be me or somebody else, here's what it's like to be an American.
He had the most incredible ability to put you in another person's shoes. I mean, that was the brilliance of his broadcast during the Blitz and the Battle of Britain. His using these little tiny details of life in London. To describe what it was like to go through this hellish period that the British were going through. And if you listen to those broadcasts or read them, you know, you can close your eyes and you're there. You're on the streets of London with him, seeing what he sees. And so he really had that extraordinary ability to do that, which was also there when he was telling the Americans about the British and vice versa during the, you know, later in the war.
He worked out of the BBC studios.
Yes. He was the American broadcasters in London all broadcast from the BBC. And the BBC was extremely important for Ed Murrow. I mean, that's really where he learned his journalism, his broadcasting. And he became very, very close. He was much closer to BBC journalists than he was to the people back home, the people at CBS back home. Because they worked together. They worked together very, very closely.
They offered him a job after the war.
Yes. I mean, actually, during the war.
Okay.
During the war.
Near the end, I think. Or
near the end of the war, Winston Churchill, through one of his aides, offered Murrow the job of basically head of broadcasting for the BBC. I mean, it's extraordinary. The British don't do that. To have an American be in charge of, you know, the British network. I mean, that was just amazing. And he knew that it was. He turned it down because, you know, he felt that an American really couldn't do that. But he was extraordinarily honored by the, and it was an honor. It was a great honor that they paid him.
Well, he sort of rewrote the book on broadcast news, or wrote the book. Maybe there hadn't really been one written yet.
Yeah.
On it, and changed the nature of it.
Yeah, well, there really hadn't. He and the men he hired to create CBS News, the correspondents that he hired during the war, before and during the war, really did write the book. I mean, there really was no such thing as broadcast news up to that point. And they really created it. They were the pioneers without question. And everybody followed in their footsteps.
You know, I guess it I didn't realize before either that how much the war changed the BBC's type of reporting.
Yeah, before the war, the BBC did not have correspondence, for one thing. They were very proper, very prim, very stuffy. I mean, their announcers used to have to wear dinner jackets, tuxedos, to broadcast. And that all changed during the war. They also did not allow different points of view to be broadcast. Mm-hmm. Before the war, they were very much in favor of Neville Chamberlain and the government, the appeasement government. It wasn't until the war began that they started actually broadcasting what was actually happening and allowing different points of view to be heard. So there was, as you say, an extraordinary change in their way of working. And Murrow agreed with it and picked up on it and used a lot of the stuff that the BBC did.
He seemed in many ways like a kindred spirit of Gil Wynant, in that he also would rather have been out on the streets with the people than in one of the fancy clubs he could have inhabited whenever he felt like it.
That's a really good insight. I think that's absolutely true. They were very close friends and had been for some time before the war. They both were people persons. They were not interested. Well, I shouldn't say that. Murrow liked kind of socializing with the high and mighty, mm-hmm, in England, but at the same time, his heart was with the man on the street, the common person. Those are the people that he broadcast about. Those were the people he really cared about. And the same was true with Gil Wynant, who did not socialize very much with high society or, you know, with the high up, the elite of London. He also was very much interested in helping ordinary people.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU, and my guest is Lynn Olson, author of Citizens of London. You know, war does strange things to people.
And, certainly
you
does.
You spent a lot of time talking about how strange it got, particularly with the sexual promiscuity and how much that changed at the time and just during the war. It was different even after the war, but it also affected these three fellows, Harriman, Murrow, and Wynant.
Yes, it did. War does strange things to people. It's unlike any normal situation you can imagine, and especially if you can picture London during the war, where, as I said, it was extremely exciting. It was also very dangerous, and people acted very differently. I mean, there was a sense of a carpe diem mentality for a lot of people. You know, live for the day, for tomorrow you may die. And many, many people lived for the day and did things that they would not do in normal situation. And there was a lot of playing around, of getting involved with other people and other people's wives, etc. And the three men, all three of them, became involved romantically with members of Churchill's family. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned before that Churchill had brought especially Wynant and Harriman into his personal life. They spent many, if not most, weekends with the Churchills in the country. And so Wynant was involved with Sarah Churchill, who was Winston Churchill's
favorite daughter.
And Harriman and Murrow were both had affairs with Pamela Churchill, who was the Prime Minister's daughter-in-law, who was married to his son Randolph. Those relationships did not occur at the same time with Murrow and Harriman.
Well, she had lots of relationships.
She had lots of relationships. She certainly
something
did.
Had to be going on at the same time, yeah, with her, because I don't know how she squeezed it all in.
Well, she said, you know, one of my favorite quotes in the book comes from her. A number of years after the war, when she was asked to talk about it, and she said, the war was a terrible thing, but if you were the right age and in the right place, it was spectacular. And for Pamela Harriman, it really was spectacular. But I emphasize that part of it is just such a totally unreal situation, you know, mm-hmm, and that people just did things that they would never have done otherwise, I think.
Sometimes it felt like a big frat party. Nothing against fraternities. But
well, yeah. I mean, it was. There was a lot of that going on. Especially, I should differentiate the Londons. There were two Londons. Mm-hmm. There was the London of the ordinary Londoner, and that did not happen to most ordinary Londoners. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of them had been bombed out of their homes. They had experienced severe rationing. Life was not good during the war for most people in London. For people who were involved in running the war, for journalists, particularly for Americans who had come over there, it was a far different story. That was the time of there were a lot of parties going on. A lot of drinking, mm-hmm. a lot of getting involved with other people, but at the same time there was a lot of serious work being done. So this huge city, there were a lot of different things going on at the same time.
Ed Murrow was in a different, worked in a different time. Certainly, did become very, very good friends with Gil Winnett, and also relatively close with Winston Churchill.
Yes.
In fact, he was with him on December 7th, the day that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Well, Murrow actually was with Roosevelt at the White House.
He was having dinner with Roosevelt.
Right. He was with Roosevelt. But the other two were with Churchill, which shows how important they were to the development of this alliance. Harriman and Winnett were with Churchill having dinner at Chequers, which is the Prime Minister's country house. And Murrow was with Roosevelt at the White House, at the time of Pearl Harbor. So they, all three of them, had first row seats into what was going on,
which is really kind of amazing.
It really is. It really is. It shows how Churchill and Roosevelt, how important they considered these three men in creating that alliance.
Churchill was extremely frustrated before that time that the United States would only extend itself as far as the Lend-Lease program, and even then they weren't particularly thrilled with the terms of that program. And there was a quote from him. It was my favorite quote from the book. He said in a speech to the House of Commons, he said, "Nothing is more dangerous in wartime than to live in the temperamental atmosphere of Gallup polls, or of feeling one's pulse or taking one's temperature. And there is only one duty, only one safe course, and that is to be right and not to fear to do or say what you believe to be right." These days, I mean, you think that we think just about polling these days as a distraction. It was just as bad back then.
Oh, yeah. In many ways, it certainly was as bad. In some ways, it was worse. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was a really great president, but he did, in my opinion, pay much too much attention to polls. He was really afraid of getting ahead of public opinion, and so really the polls became his god to some extent. And he was constantly referring to them to see how far he could go. I mean, one must point out that there was still a great amount of isolationism, mm-hmm. in this country, even up to Pearl Harbor. So it was not a straw man he was facing. He did have opponents, very strong opponents. But at the same time, there was a feeling on the part of a number of people, including many of his high administration officials, that he wasn't doing enough leading, that he wasn't explaining to the American people enough about the danger of seeing Britain go down. That he was paying much too much attention to the polls and not enough attention to what he should be doing.
There is a great chapter in the book about the American flyers who joined the RAF before the U.S. entered the war.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Eagle Squadron.
Right.
There was that whole element to the book that I wasn't expecting. It's about all the other Americans that played such key roles in the hearts and minds of the English at the time, and the strategy of the war itself.
Right. Even though I chose these three men as my main characters, I make the point in the book over and over and over that there were many, many, many Americans, mm-hmm. who were devoted to the idea of helping Britain before we got into the war, and then once we did get into the war, to making sure this alliance worked. So it wasn't just these three men. And I should also mention, even though I don't talk about them very much, that there were a number of Britons, of the British, who did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you. I think some of the most interesting ones are the young Americans who went over to England well before we got into the war to volunteer for the British Armed Services, particularly for the Royal Air Force, the RAF. And there were, you know, several hundred Americans who were flying in all American squadrons attached to the RAF.
And these were wealthy people. They, by and large, weren't they? Or
well, no, they came really from all over.
I mean,
a number of them, you know, had been barnstorming pilots. You know, kids who came out off the farms, you know, in the Midwest, mm-hmm. and had become pilots. Some of them were wealthy, came from the East. So you know, they were from all over, but they all shared several common attitudes or common characteristics. They all loved to fly. They all loved danger. They all loved excitement. And a fair number of them just thought we needed to do something more than what we were doing. And so they came over and volunteered. You know, during the Battle of Britain, there were, you know, five, six, seven Americans who flew in the Battle of Britain. Nobody really knows about that, but they did. And there, by the way, they were breaking the law of their country by doing that. And in fact, were risking the loss of their citizenship by doing that because the neutrality acts were still in effect, which basically said you could not fight for another country's armed services.
Let's take another short break, and then I want to come back and talk about the famous polo player who helped save D-Day with Lynn Olson, author of Citizens of London. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll get to the calls that are waiting when we return to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get more radio. The WOSU Spring Membership Drive begins soon, and if we raise $20,000 before May 6th, we'll take one day off the drive. Get more programming and less pledging when you make your gift to WOSU. It's fast and easy and will help us reach our overall $175,000 goal. Get more of the radio you love to listen to by making your contribution right now. Visit WOSU.org/pledgefree to make your gift.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear an update of the humanitarian relief and reconstruction efforts in Haiti following the earthquake. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU. And remember, you can hear more from WOSU anytime at our website, WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archive shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/allsides. 56 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, and a high of 72 this afternoon. A few clouds tonight and a low of 52 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 82, and then clouds move in on Saturday, bringing rain and a chance of a thunderstorm for Saturday. A high of 75. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Lynn Olson, author of Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. One of them was the world-famous polo player. He helped get developed the aircraft that helped save D-Day. Right, Lynn?
That's right. His name was Tommy Hitchcock, and I had heard of him a little bit before I started research, but I had no idea what he did. He really popularized polo in this country in the 1920s and 1930s. He was probably the most famous polo player, probably the best polo player in the world at that point. And in that period, virtually every American knew who Tommy Hitchcock was. He was an incredible celebrity. F. Scott Fitzgerald modeled two of his characters in Great Gatsby and Tender is the Night, his two best-known novels, after Tommy Hitchcock, and called him, you know, the biggest hero he had ever had. So this polo player also had been a student of Gil Winant at St. Paul's School in New Hampshire, the prep school in New Hampshire. Winant had started out his career as a teacher of history. And so he knew, he had known Tommy Hitchcock ever since Hitchcock was a teenager. Hitchcock had gone from St. Paul's to World War I, where he had flown for the Lafayette Escadrille, for the French Air Force. He was one of the Americans who had flown during World War I. So he had been a fighter pilot in World War I. And when World War II started, he was desperate to get into the war. He was too old. He was in his early 40s. The U.S. Air Force wouldn't have him. And so Wynant asked him if he would like to come to London as his military attaché at the U.S. Embassy, which he did. And he did, in fact, as you say, he helped save D-Day. And how he did it was he crusaded for the adoption of a fighter plane called the P-51 Mustang, which turned out to be to save the war in effect. It was a long range fighter plane that protected the bombers when they went in to in the bombing campaign over Germany. And if American and British bombers had not been able to get rid of German bombers and German fighter planes, then we couldn't have had D-Day. Mm-hmm. The skies had to be clear of enemy planes by D-Day, and it didn't look like it was going to happen even a few months before June 6, 1944. But thanks to Tommy Hitchcock, this P-51 Mustang was finally adopted, and in the nick of time was introduced, and in fact did was the main was one of the key reasons why, in fact, it did work. I mean, we got rid of all those German planes.
Yeah, was there a German, someone high up in the military in Germany that when they saw and heard about the planes realized that was the end?
Yeah, that's right. I think it was Goering, who's the head mm-hmm. of the Luftwaffe, told American interrogators after the war that he said, I knew it was getting bad, you know, when I looked up and they were coming into Hamburg or whatever. But when I saw those American planes over Berlin, I knew it was over. And it was because of this extraordinary fighter plane that could protect, not only protect American bombers, but also shoot down by the thousands German planes. That's the reason it happened.
Let's take a phone call now from Richard. Richard, you're on the air with Lynn Olson.
Yes, hi. I'm glad to listen to this show. You mentioned earlier all the Americans who went to Canada. You know, the British had great foresight in setting up the Commonwealth Air Training Plan. About 10,000 Americans or more, 10,000 to 14,000 went there. But one of the more famous alumni of that group was from here in Columbus, Don Gentile. His family or his still owns, I think, a wine business here in Columbus. But I was interested in his story because his real name was Dominic Salvatore Gentile. He was an Italian-American, which was not common at the time. And as it turned out, my stepfather ended up in a group in North Africa with a fighter group, first flying Spitfires, and then ended up with the plane you just mentioned, the P-51 Mustang. But while he was in North Africa, he pointed out that some Americans of that group who went over to the, you mentioned the Eagle Squadrons, mm-hmm. Ended up in North Africa with the Desert Air Force, and a few transferred into his group. And so it was a large number of Americans went over there. I think you also touched on the the issue of you couldn't serve or swear allegiance to a foreign government or a king, as the case may be. And I had done some research on this because I've written two books on the subject. And what they did was basically say, essentially, they would follow the orders of their superior officers. In other words, they never swore allegiance to the king. But when some were sworn in by error, the document they signed had allegiance to the King of England. And so they had some difficulty when they were transferring back into the American Air Force. Well, technically, they had lost their citizenship, so that was a small number of them, but it was an issue because of simply the wording of the document. But
you mentioned that, how they kind of got around that, didn't you, Lynn?
Yeah, I did. Well, I mentioned a group of Americans who joined the Army, not the Air Force, but it was they had the same problem, and it was Gil Winant that came up with their in their particular instance with the idea, as you say, as the caller says, that they would swear allegiance to their commander rather than to the King of England.
Right.
But your points are fascinating and absolutely right. I mean, one thing that was interesting to me is how many of those young Americans who joined the RAF, who were in the Eagle Squadron, then went on to the U.S. Army Air Force, to the U.S. Air Force, and were incredibly, including Don Gentile, who were incredibly important in training these young American flyers who had not flown in combat, before. They were extremely valuable because of they already had combat experience.
Right, and those Eagle Squadrons formed essentially the first full American fighter group, but one of the first that entered combat was the 4th Fighter Group, and that was all three of the Eagle Squadrons actually came in en masse as opposed to singly, as in many mm-hmm. cases with some of the other flyers. But yeah, it's a fascinating story for those Americans who went, and I'm really glad to hear that you're touching on the subject. I'll have to get your book.
Get the book, Richard. It's so good. I loved it. Thanks, Richard, for your call.
All right. You're welcome. Yeah. Bye bye.
Bye. I don't mean to gush, Lynn, but I thought, wow, this would make such a great movie, because there's real pathos with these three guys. I mean, there's the romance and the, the politics and the danger.
Well, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. Yeah, I mean, it was a time like no other, and people like no other. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary story.
You know, the cover of the book, it has a photograph that includes Churchill and Gil Winant mm-hmm. in it, and I don't know if it's on purpose or a coincidence that Gil is almost in the center of the picture. He, for me, as far as the humans go versus the city, feels like the most special character in the book. Maybe it's because it's the one I knew the least about.
Well, you know, to be honest, he is my favorite character. I mean, I love all three of them, but because so few people have ever heard of him, they don't know the contributions he made to creating this extraordinarily important alliance and to keeping it alive. I really highlighted him probably more than the other two. And it is just astonishing that so few people mm-hmm. have ever heard of him. It's just amazing to me.
He was very shy, as you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But why don't – is it that the only reason? He was kind of ignored after the war.
He was ignored after the war. Yes, I think part of it is because he was very much a man who did not like to operate in the spotlight. He liked to work behind the scenes. So he did not get the attention and the publicity, for example, that Harriman and Murrow did. He was Roosevelt's man. Remember, I mentioned he was a Republican.
That's right.
And he had left the Republic. The Republicans had basically cut him off because he supported Roosevelt in the New Deal. Not only supported him, but endorsed Roosevelt.
Well, he ran Social Security Administration.
Yes, he ran the Social Security. He was the first director of the Social Security Administration just after Social Security was formed.
Qualify him as a socialist now.
Yeah, right. And in fact, the Republicans in 1936 in the presidential election smeared Social Security, the new program, and tried to get rid of it. And he was so furious, Gil Winant was so furious, that he quit as director and made several radio speeches attacking the Republicans, his own party, and then endorsed Roosevelt for re-election. Well, that was it for the Republicans. They wanted nothing to do with him. So from then on, he was FDR's guy. And when Roosevelt died in 1945, Gil Winant was left with nothing. The Republicans didn't want him, and the new president, Harry Truman, didn't know him and didn't really want him. So at the end of the war, he had really nothing. And you ask why he is not remembered. One of the reasons is that 2 years after the war, he killed himself. He was incredibly depressed, and for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. And he went home to New Hampshire and he killed himself. And I think his suicide, which was incredibly shocking, mm-hmm. To many people, and I think that played a role too in the fact that he's been so forgotten since then.
Yeah, that was a tough thing to read. If I didn't know, hopefully it's not a spoiler for anybody who reads the book. But I did, you know, as you're reading the book, you start to learn about this person. And
it is even, you know, when I was writing it, and obviously I knew all the details. Even when I was writing the scene where he did, in fact, take his life, it was difficult to write because he was such a not only an important person in terms of the Alliance, but just a person that brought so much to so many people, and you know, that was a beacon of idealism. I mean, you don't have many people like him around.
And sort of ageless.
Yes, yes. You know, there weren't many people like him back then, mm-hmm. and there certainly aren't many people like him now. And to have this man who cared so deeply about helping others, and who meant so much to so many people, feels so, you know, devastated and so lacking purpose that he took his own life. It was really, really tough. Really tough for me, actually,
yeah.
Writing about it.
Once you learn so much about him.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole other relationship in the book that I don't want to forget to talk about, and that's with the Londoners and the United States Armed Forces when they invaded London,
yeah.
before,
yeah.
D-Day.
Right.
It was really, I mean, there were bad times, but there were a lot of good times,
there
too.
Were a lot of, yeah. It was a difficult period. I mean, just imagine, you know, almost 2 million Americans descended on this little island, which is the size of Michigan or Georgia, and on a country most of whose residents had never ever met an American before, and they just came in and engulfed this country, and you know. The British by that time, you know, had been at war for 5 years. They were living very difficult lives, very little food. Life was not all that great. And then all of a sudden, these young, brash Americans, who were used to, living fairly well, are in their midst. And they're paid much more than the British soldiers, and they have money galore, and they're brash, and they think they know it all, and the British look at them and say, you know, we've held the fort until you guys get here, and you know. So there was a lot of tension and a lot of suspicion and a lot of difficulty between the Brits and the American soldiers, but at the same time, there was also a lot of warmth and a lot of friendships created and a lot of marriages created. So it was an interesting, fascinating, complex time.
The relationships with the people, lots of the letters, you know, when the servicemen would write those letters that would be sent out in case they ever were killed in battle, many of them were addressed to people that they stayed with in England.
Yeah, I end the chapter about the Americans, the influx of Americans with that. For all the problems there were, and there were many, there were extremely close relationships in the end between thousands, hundreds of thousands of American soldiers and the British people. And in fact, when the U.S. Army left Britain and went to France at D-Day, for the next month after the invasion of Normandy, the letters, I think it was a third of the letters sent by American soldiers in France were sent to British homes.
Which, oh, that's right, yeah.
Which shows you, the strength and the importance of those ties that they had created with the British.
There was an important relationship between the British and African-American troops as well. Where they were accepted there.
They were. This is a time still when the armed forces were segregated. And black troops, African-American troops, were treated quite miserably, quite frankly, by the American military. There was there was total segregation, and many of the African-American troops were, you know, were treated quite miserably by their colleagues in the army and other services. The British people at that point had very, very few blacks, very few minorities in their country, and they thought this was just outrageous. And they came to the defense of black troops, American black troops, and made very clear that they were not going to follow that same kind of segregation policy that the U.S. military was enforcing.
They enforced another segregation. That was the American troops from the British troops and anybody else. They had special clubs for the American troops.
They did. They had special clubs for the African American troops. And in fact, you know, they tried to get them thrown out. Some military officials tried to get them thrown out of you know, British hotels, etc. And as I said, the British wouldn't put up with that. You know, it was just kind of almost a mass movement on the part of the British public. Mm-hmm. They just made very clear that they were not going to follow it. I mean, pubs would have signs, you know, saying basically, you know, only Americans welcome are Negro troops, and you know, so they really fought back against that.
You know, we only have about a minute and a half left, but I wondered, you know, just because of our relationship and what has evolved over the last 6 or 7 years with England, wondering about what sort of relevance this book has for our relationships with England today. Or maybe just in general, how we do things.
I think, first of all, I think for all the problems we have had with Britain in the last 6 or 7 years or that they've had with us, it's still a special relationship. Britain is still our closest ally. And regardless of what happens, I think we'll continue to be our closest ally. We need Britain, and Britain needs us. And what happened during the war helped cement that for all the problems, and there were many, many, many problems in that alliance. The closeness of these working relationships where people actually got, the Brits got to know us, and we got to know them. That was key. And what it says, I think, to me, is the power and the importance of personal diplomacy.
Lynn Olson, author of Citizens of London, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anne.
All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.